Yeah, so my name is Sheila Garcia Masari. Pronouns are she, her. I work as the online learning librarian at the University of California, Santa Cruz. I'm fairly new to this role. It's coming up to a year. But I've spent about 10 years in libraries, starting out in public libraries, and then moving to academic, primarily in like instructional liaison roles.
Okay, I want to back up like one more step and ask like, what is a doula?
Doula. Yes. So a doula, the way I understand it, is someone that advocates for the needs of a patient, particularly in childbirth. So the doula is there, kind of similar to a midwife, and is there, listens to what the patient needs. And the idea is that when someone is in childbirth, they are in a lot of pain and are not fully like centered in terms of the decisions that they're making. They're being asked to make these decisions like, we're going to do a C-section. Is that okay with you? And this person is in a lot of pain and active labor. And if they didn't want a C-section, the doula is there to say she doesn't want this. And can in turn, like it really, doulas focus on the needs of the patient. What did the patient say they wanted before they were in this really painful active labor sort of place? And so it's more of an advocacy role is the way I see the research doula, the doula in general.
And so, okay, I think that aligns with my understanding of a doula too. Do you think there would be an advocacy aspect to a research doula?
I think so. I think that well, I talked a lot about journal articles and the amount of journal articles out there, but just in general, there's a lot of information out there. Newspaper articles, blogs, Twitter, that's now X. I don't know about that. Like social media. And when you do library research in an academic library, you're just being directed toward, journal articles, books, but you're not really directed toward more expansive things like special collections or oral histories, or even just networking of like, let me tell you this one person that knows a lot about this thing and you could talk to them. And so I think that there is a place for librarian to be a doula where they're like have that deep subject knowledge where they're like, and this person wrote a whole book on this and I know them and you can connect with them.
What do you think it would take to make it so that that could be your job?
So that you could be a research doula. I think funding. I think a big one would be funding. There should be enough for the. I think that the amount of careers available has expanded, and I think that a lot of universities are expanding what they offer in order to attract more students. But I also don't think they're necessarily investing in the information infrastructure that they need. I think there's this idea that like the information's just there, and as long as the information's just there, the students can find it and it's fine. But that's not necessarily true. Students can't find a lot of things, and where I am, I think that by and large, people are spread thin a lot and they want to help. And it takes more time than maybe others think it does to answer a research question because, as I said, we have to do research too when someone comes in with a question and be like, where is that again? And then direct them to it. So it's less of, oh, yeah, I know this off the top of my head, and more like, let me see where that is located. And then let me direct you to what you're looking for. Yeah. And then for me, like I'm an online librarian. And so my job is to create online asynchronous content to help guide students on how to use the library. But also largely to think about the big questions around bias and what it means to like be a scholar and how you can claim that identity, even if you haven't published a journal article. As I spent the last year, I did like a listening tour with students and I listened to what students needed. And I think that in order to make up for the lack of people that are employed, they like create these online asynchronous content so the students can just view it on their own. And that way you're not spread so thin, you know, talking to each individual class or doing live classes at all, like, because that can easily get to be a lot. And this way they can do it on their own time. But there's a lot that's lost in that, which is why I'm like, it's very difficult to think of technology and digital being the end all solution to everything. What I realized in my role is that online asynchronous by itself isn't going to work for a lot of students. The students need some sort of method of engaging beyond interactive to know that there's someone out there that's helping, that's like a direct line to me so that I can directly answer their questions. It can't just sit there on its own. And that in turn means that it's a lot of work for me, right? And every time I bring it up, the thing is like, well, you want to make sure your work is sustainable. Yes. And that means that maybe there could be more than one person hired doing this, you know, because I work for a Hispanic serving institution. I also work for an Asian Pacific Islander serving institution, has both designations. And a lot of the students that come from those backgrounds come from very collectivist backgrounds where you support each other and you learn from each other. And online strips that away. It becomes, I'm learning by myself with a computer. So as much as I want to think of the future as more digital, sometimes I'm thinking it might be less digital. And we'd be moving back more toward that human connection, that analog sort of thing, even though it's hard to keep up with all of that research. I think research could be just creating. I think there's this idea that research is finding quote unquote new information and packaging it for academia. But I think that research is generally creating. There was something that I was listening to recently. It was a podcast, but I forget what the name of it was. But someone said something really powerful in which they said, for a lot of historically marginalized communities, they don't feel like they're part of the scholarly conversation, but it's like they literally are doing research on your community where you're actually living, what it's like to be in that community. And so the fact that your personal experience is often not considered research, it's considered a bias, doesn't make sense if they're researching your community. And I think that's particularly true for Indigenous populations. And so that's when I think about the scholarly conversation, I think of it as like expanding beyond that. We just had to talk about scholarly communication and equity inclusion. And I was like, there tends to be this, we watched a webinar in which someone said, it's not up to the publishers to change the way that we publish and decide, you know, value. It's up to the scholarly community to do it. And I was like, it's kind of up to both because the publishers make money off of this and the scholarly community attracts more scholars. And it's all really just wrapped up in capitalism. Like, universities may be nonprofit, but they're always worried about how many people they have enrolled. And, you know, showing their brand value in that way. I actually attended a webinar all about brand value and how you can hire a consultant to help your brand because this is the future for universities. Universities are building brands. Right. And they have slogans and it's not just a mascot. It's been for years coming, but it's like now it's even more important because a lot of universities, they don't have enough local students and they're reaching out internationally to try to get more international students. And so brand is very important. It's almost being, it's basically being run like a corporation, like a for-profit corporation in that way. And I'm like, journal articles are exactly the same way. They want more subscribers. They want more sales. And at the end of the day, that's what it is. So if we could somehow take the capitalism out of research, I think it would be great. Because I learned so much from zines. I learned so much from spoken oral storytelling. I don't think it needs to be tangible, right? And I think that's the other thing is that a lot of times when people think about research, it's like a journal article, a published thing, and it doesn't have to be a tangible thing. A lot of like my community was oral storytelling. And like now all those stories are just here because they're not written down. And so that's okay. Like it doesn't have to be written down. Like I think that's the thing, is like there's just this need of like all knowledge must be written down, must be available in a written format. And it's like, it's okay if some stories are lost with time. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just the way things are meant to be. So like trying to take away this capitalistic slanted, this slant of like, it needs to be preserved forever. It's okay sometimes if things break away and fall away, because that's just embracing how time works. So when I think of the scholarly conversation, that is my ideal of like just letting things sit and honoring how things were created in the format that were created by the creator, and being okay with that and saying that's still a scholarly item, that's still part of a scholarly conversation.